Hey guys, this is Nick. Just jumping in here at the top to let you know I'm posting a Patreon exclusive on the feed today. I'm recording this a little ahead of time because my wife and I are going to California for Thanksgiving. Figured I would put out this elect exclusive edition of The Death of Death to give you guys a peek and a taste at what it's like. I've only done this one other time, but I thought it would be cool to just put a Patreon episode out here. And you can see kind of what it's like. If you want full access to the exclusive podcast, along with some other benefits, you can go to patreon.com/deathofdeath. You can also go to deathofdeath.net and click Patreon. Patrons also get the free show 3 days early. And recently they got all these free t-shirts. I sent every patron the new t-shirt with the podcast logo on it free of charge, just because they've already been supporting the show. So go sign up. It's only $4 a month. And if you want that t-shirt, you can also go to the Death of Death online store. You can get there from the homepage by clicking shop. And you can also go straight to shop.deathofdeath.net. Still have plenty of shirts. We did regretfully sell out of the XXLs, but I'm hoping to get some more in stock soon. We also have plenty of those stickers with the logo as well, if you like to blast things with stickers like I do. All right, this episode was the Elect Exclusive Edition Halloween episode, but you and I both know that it's always Halloween here on The Death of Death. I tell a few creepy stories from the Bible as well as some things from church history, so enjoy. To the Elect Exclusive Edition of The Death of Death. It's wonderful to be with you all. We have a Halloween episode today. Very excited to talk about some of this. I've been planning this episode since the summertime, so I hope this lives up to my expectations. And I seriously doubt that you have any expectations, so we're probably good there. Time to have some fun, talk about creepy stuff from church history, even a couple from the Bible. I've titled our tales today, really just in my notes for my own self-amusement, but I wanted you to hear them. Our tales today will include The Writing on the Wall, The Beast of Revelation, St. Denis's Heady Sermon, Bone Up on Your Knowledge of Ossuaries, and lastly, the Cadaver Synod of 897. Synod? Synod? I'm going to mispronounce that through the whole episode. Cool. So first up, we have The Writing on the Wall. So this is a story from the Bible. It's my favorite Bible story in terms of spooky stuff. You like creepy things like severed hands floating in the air? I know you do. You probably already know what the story is referring to. It's Daniel 5. So we have to back up a few years to set the scene here in Daniel 5. When Jerusalem fell to Babylon and was exiled the first time in 597 BC, Nebuchadnezzar overthrew them, and he ransacked the temple and stole the vessels that had been used for temple worship. Solomon made these vessels out of gold and silver, and it's not until you really remember this story from Daniel that you notice how big a deal the Bible makes about it. But I noticed reading through my Bible this time that 2 Kings 24:13 and 2 Chronicles 36:7 both draw attention to the fact that Nebuchadnezzar stole the vessels during the siege. And then Daniel 1:2 even reiterates it at the beginning of the book, foreshadowing chapter 5, just in case you weren't paying attention to both historical records in the other books. But the vessels are stolen and then never really talked about until now. They were presumably just sitting in storage somewhere, probably collecting dust, until King Belshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar's son, decided he wanted to throw a party. So he gets these gold and silver numbers out for his friends and wives and concubines to drink out of. And I don't know if
the drinking was part of a ritual or just accidental to it, but the general vibe of the evening was paganism. So they're praising all these false gods while drinking out of the vessels from the temple. And then the most delightfully spooky thing happened. A disembodied hand appears out of nowhere and starts writing on the wall. So it says then that the king's color changed. Yeah, I certainly bet it did. It says his knees knocked together. Now, it doesn't say this, so we can't know for sure. But come on, you know he peed himself. I mean, come on, he had to have, right? Like, a disembodied hand was writing on the wall. This is actually where the term writing on the wall comes from. It means an ominous warning. So Belshazzar can't read the writing, so he offers a reward to anyone who can interpret it for him and calls in his enchanters and astrologers, but they can't read the writing either. So then the queen tells Belshazzar to call in Daniel. Daniel comes in, and he's able to read the writing. It says three things. The first thing it says twice, and then it says two more things. It says, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. So it actually says that part twice, and in Hebrew, that means emphasis for sure. So there's real emphasis on the fact that God has brought Belshazzar's kingdom to an end. And it goes on to say, you have been weighed in the balances and been found wanting. Your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. So luckily for Daniel, Belshazzar is true to his promise to reward the interpreter. So Daniel receives a purple robe and a golden chain, and Belshazzar makes a proclamation that Daniel is to be third in the kingdom. So can you imagine that? Like imagine Donald Trump getting a spooky message on his wall from a disembodied hand during like a pagan sex party, and you know it happens probably every like Thursday night or something. So he gets this message on the wall, and you're the only one who can interpret it. So you come in and see that it says, America is going to fall, you're unjust, and I'm giving your kingdom to Canada and Mexico. And then Donald Trump is so grateful to hear this that he gives you some gifts and makes you Speaker of the House. That would be one of the more notable days of your life, unless, of course, you later went on to survive a night in the lion's den and did all the other things that Daniel did in his life. So I said luckily for Daniel that Belshazzar was true to his word, but unluckily for Daniel, God was also true to his word to Belshazzar, and Belshazzar died that very night. So the drama of Daniel's story wasn't quite over, because the next ruler didn't have a pre-existing relationship with him. However, that does bring our tale for today to an end. So next up, we have the Beast of Revelation. This isn't supposed to be an episode on eschatology, so let's just get a few things out of the way. When John wrote Revelation, it must have had some meaning to the people receiving the letter. So when John says this in Revelation 13:18, this calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. That must have some sort of meaning for the people in the first century reading the letter. Otherwise, it just doesn't really make any sense. So, you know, obviously that brings us to cryptograms. Cryptograms are codes where letters or numbers are substituted by other letters or numbers. And in the first century, it was very common to use these types of codes. We still use Roman numerals to this day. And those are just letters substituting numbers. So it wasn't uncommon to use numbers in a similar way to make a code. And so what John is doing is taking letters of a name and making a code out of it, and it comes out to 666. Sometimes. Did you also know that there is a textual variant in Revelation? There are actually two numbers of the beast in Revelation, depending on the manuscript. You read 666, of course, if you know your Iron Maiden, but the older number is 616. So the oldest manuscripts actually say 616 is the number of the beast. So we can do what we normally do when there's a textual variant and choose the oldest or the most common variant. But in this particular case, we don't really need to. It's really cool that we don't need to. So if you use the first century coding system of letters and numbers and take the Hebrew version of Emperor Nero's name, you know what you get? 666. That's interesting. Guess what happens when you translate the Greek version of Nero's name? 616. So that's not a contradiction at all. Depending on who was making the copy of the text and what language they spoke, the number would be a little different depending on the spelling of the name. But who the number points to is very consistent. Anyone who knows their Left Behind series knows the beast in Revelation is supposed to be some politically successful end of days fella who creates a one world currency and gets some kind of a head injury. So how am I going to get away with convincing you that the beast in Revelation already lived 2,000 years ago? Well, when you look into Nero and some of the things he did, it's not really hard to believe at all. Especially if you accept the interpretation that Revelation is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem that happened in 70 AD. Nero is kind of an anticlimactic, you know, suspect for the beast when you're expecting the Left Behind version. But when you look at his track record and some of the atrocities that he was responsible for, it's not too hard to accept. So it all kind of revolves around the Great Fire in 64 AD. Rumored to be started by Nero himself. He blamed the Christians for it, and this led to a massive amount of Christians being murdered. He had Christians crucified, he had them fed to his dogs, and he even had some of them set on fire and used as lanterns to light his garden at night. So that's just swell. Peter and Paul were actually executed under Nero's reign in 64 and 65 AD respectively. Revelation says the beast will have authority for 42 months, which is about how long Nero reigned after the fire, before he died. So his death is an interesting story as well. He was about to do the greatest service he had ever done to the world by killing himself, but he couldn't work up the nerve to do it, so he asked one of his assistants to kill themselves first to show him how it's done. And it's unclear whether they went through with that, but he ended up having his secretary, Epaphroditos, kill him instead because he didn't have the stones to do it, so he had his right-hand guy kill him. Before dying, he was clearly mentally ill. The least of these examples is how he would lock people in theaters while he performed music for hours and hours, not letting anyone leave, and making them clap and pay very close attention. And we'll never know what the music sounded like, but come on, it had to be terrible, right? Like, no one as entitled and self-unaware as Nero could have possibly been a good musician. Like, he was the Hunter Biden of the Roman Empire. He was just a complete degenerate who did whatever the hell he wanted, whenever he wanted, and he thought he was the greatest thing. He was also known for playing a little game. Hey, everybody, I'm going to tie you to this pole while I put on this fun wolf costume. I probably shouldn't be joking about this. He would have some people, and some sources say children, but it was probably more general than that because other sources said it may have been a capital punishment, but he would have them tied naked to a pole, and then he would put on these really fun animal furs, pretending to be a wacky wild animal, and he would attack them like a wild animal. Sources say he would specifically attack the genitals, and I'll leave it at that. He was also responsible for the execution of his mother. Historically, there's a lot of variation on the method of execution, some even involving cannibalism. But it's, consistent across the board that he was responsible for it. So we are talking about a man who was willing to murder his own mother, and he may even have eaten her. And the worst of his crimes, by my metric, if you don't count the persecution of the Christians, which was probably carried out by soldiers, the most heinous, if you can even qualify such a thing, a lot of these are kind of apples and oranges, was what he did to his wife and unborn baby. His pregnant wife, Poppaea, which I did not take the time to learn the pronunciation of, so hopefully that's right, Poppaea accused Nero of spending too much time at the races. And, you know, he didn't take kindly to that accusation. And he responded, you know, as you do, by kicking her to death. Kicking his wife and his unborn baby to death. So with all of his abominable acts, and especially his persecution of the early church, it is clear that he is overqualified for the title of the Beast of Revelation. He is historically known, it's generally true, that he was really the first emperor to really persecute Christianity. So if that doesn't earn him the title of the Beast, just not sure what does. So next up, we have St. Denis of Paris's heady sermon. So kind of a bizarre martyr story that is, you know, it's a legend. I don't believe that this actually happened. And a lot of the facts about St. Denis are actually unverified historically. We do know a few things to be, you know, in all probability true, but there's a lot of stuff that we just don't know. So, you know, this is a tale just for fun. St. Denis of Paris lived in the 3rd century, and according to tradition, he was the Bishop of Paris. He was the first Bishop of Paris, and he was originally thought to be the convert that Paul made at the Areopagus in Acts 17, and then went on to be the first Bishop of Athens. But if you listen to this week's episode of The Free Show, we talked about Acts 17 in depth and mentioned the converts that Paul made there. But now that we know more about Denis's historicity, it's known that he actually lived in the 3rd century, like I said earlier, making that quite impossible unless he was, you know, over 200 years old. Pretty much everything we know about him is legend. It's obvious he existed and was the Bishop of Paris, but a lot of the detail of his life is unverified, like I said. Lucky for us, spooky stories aren't about fact and historicity. It's about the spooks, so it's about the creep. Denis was originally sent from Italy to convert the region of Gaul. Gaul no longer exists, but it used to be a huge area in Western Europe. It encompassed the areas known today as France, Luxembourg, Belgium, and parts of Switzerland, Italy, the Netherlands, and Germany. It was mostly inhabited by Celtic tribes, which ties in nicely to our Halloween theme, because most of what we know of Halloween today originates with Celtic tribes like the Druids. It also makes sense that if at the time of Denis it was mostly populated by pagan tribes, that men like him would be breaking mostly unbroken ground when it came to spreading the gospel. Pope Fabian sent out what are known as the Apostles to the Gauls in 245 AD. 7 bishops were sent as missionaries to Christianize the region of Gaul. Denis was one of those 7. It was there that he was made the first Bishop of Paris. So the Roman Emperor at the time, Decius, sent out an edict in 250 AD that everyone in the Roman Empire had to perform a sacrifice to Roman gods. This sacrifice had to be done in front of a magistrate who would issue a signed certificate that it had been done. After that, the magistrate would take the Roman citizen's temperature and test them for COVID-19 and administer a vaccine accordingly. Oh, nope, that's next year, sorry. But there are actually certificates surviving that prove this really happened. You probably know where this is going. You know, because back in 250 AD, Christians actually disobeyed the state for the sake of their religion, which led to a widespread persecution. And it was such a huge event that it's actually known as the Decian persecution. So we actually don't know how many Christians were put to death. I did find an estimate of 3,500, but we don't actually know for sure. So this was largely a political move by Decius. He wanted to, you know, have people prove their loyalty to the state, and aside from the Jews, who were exempted from the edict, anyone of another religion found themselves making a tough decision between loyalty to the state and loyalty to their religion. You know, would you compromise your faith for the sake of the empire, or would you risk being put to death? Pretty tough choice. Pope Fabian, who we mentioned earlier, was the one who sent out the apostles to the Gauls. was among the numerous martyrs in the Decian persecution. And unfortunately, the focus of our story, Saint Denis, was also among those executed for their faith. He and two of his fellow clergymen were beheaded on the hill now known as Montmartre. It is the highest hill in Paris, and at the time was likely a Druid holy place, once again tying back to Halloween. Montmartre actually means Mount of the Martyrs, and it's believed that this incident is how it got its name. You may find some sources saying it means Mount of Mars, and, you know, apparently Mars and Mercury were both also associated with this hill early on. It's actually not clear what it means. It could mean one or both of these things. So here's where our story gets spooky. Legend has it that after Denis was beheaded, he picked up his head and walked for several miles while his disembodied head preached a sermon. So there's actually an entire category of Christian art known as cephalophores. These are depictions of saints holding their own severed heads, and Saint Denis is considered to be the first cephalophore. John Chrysostom actually said that the severed head of a martyr was scarier to the devil than when it was able to speak. So we talked about this on the free show not too long ago, that the blood of the saints is the seed of the church. Persecution tends to be followed by explosions of church growth. Eventually, Denis stopped preaching and died, probably dropped his head, and it kind of toppled across the ground. And the spot that's traditionally considered to be the place he died is now the Basilica of Saint Denis, a large abbey in the city of Saint Denis, which is just outside of Paris. He's got a whole city named after him. So not only do we have the spook factor of a headless corpse walking around with his talking head, but we have an encouragement that no matter how bad Christian persecution from the state gets, the legacy of the body of Christ is greater. And none of those poor schmucks who made the sacrifice for the Roman Empire have a city named after them. So that's something to think about. All right, next up, it's time to bone up on your knowledge of ossuaries. So we have a spooky structure to talk about, actually, you know, a couple of them. Mainly, we're talking about the Sedlec Ossuary, located in the Czech Republic. It is a small chapel beneath the cemetery Church of All Saints, and it contains the bones from between 40,000 to 70,000 skeletons. Now, that number struck me, and it struck me what a wide margin that is. That number tells me single-handedly that whatever poor guy had to count all those bones lost track at about 40,000 and rounded up the maximum. 39,997. 39,998. 39,998. Okay, screw it. It's about 40,000 to 70,000. That ought to cover it. So not only does this ossuary contain the bones, but it actually uses them as decorations. I'm linking to pictures in the show notes, and you guys seriously should check them out. It's magnificent. Especially the chandelier. I want something like that in my apartment. Contains at least one of every bone from the human body, and it looks pretty metal. So there's a legend that in 1278, an abbot sprinkled dirt from Golgotha on this spot. That's, Calvary, the hill that Jesus was crucified on, which made the cemetery a hot spot for burial, and everyone wanted to be in the VIP graveyard. In the 1300s, during the Black Plague, a large number of dead people made the cemetery pretty cramped. And in the 1400s, after the Hussite Wars, it was even worse. So in 1400, they built a Gothic church in the center of the cemetery, and it was built with a lower level, like a basement, to be used as an ossuary for all of the displaced bones that were moved to make way for the church. So around 1511, a half-blind monk was given the job of digging up bones and arranging them in the ossuary, and something about his partial blindness just makes this sound like a scene out of a horror movie. Like, what's that across the cemetery in the fog? Oh, that's just the blind monk digging up bones and quietly whistling Jeepers Creepers to himself. not creepy at all. I'd say the Sedlak ossuary took the arrangement of bones to a new level, but that's, you know, far from the only spot to do something like that. The St. Francis Monastery in Peru has an ossuary beneath it with some creatively arranged bones, as does the Capela dos Ossos, English name Chapel of Bones, in Portugal, has an entire wall of skull and bones. The Skull Chapel in Poland at St. Bartholomew's Church might actually rival the Sedlak ossuary in a lot of ways. The walls are entirely made of skull and bones, and the ceiling has this cool, like, geometric-looking pattern from wall to wall. It's really something. So why do so many churches make a practice of arranging skulls and bones into decoration? Well, it's the memento mori. The memento mori is a symbolic reminder of the inevitability of death. The church has a long history of doing this, from early church fathers like Jerome keeping a skull on his desk while working on the Latin Vulgate, all the way to early American Puritans that, you know, painted skulls into their portraits. And it really wasn't until recently in church history that we started to be afraid of death imagery or anything that looked too metal, you know. So here on this show, we stand in a long line of Christian tradition by talking about death and keeping little reminders around that death is inevitable, like the podcast logo. That's an example of a memento mori. So next up, our last story, which is a true story, is the story of a pope being put on a very bizarre trial. This is the Cadaver Synod. Between 896 and 904, that's only 8 years, there was a new pope every single year. Now, I'm no Catholic, but that seems like a lot of popes. I think I've only seen two popes get elected in my lifetime. This pope's troubles start, you know, before he was even pope. In 876, John VIII issued some accusations against Formosus in the Santa Maria Rotunda Synod. Can you even say that without doing that Italian hand purse gesture thing? Well, that's a comment ago. There was more than one accusation against Formosus, but the most serious was that he tried to usurp John's papacy, and for this he was excommunicated. In 879, at another synod where John was supposed to confirm Formosus's excommunication, it's rumored that Formosus himself was there and begged forgiveness, and in exchange for having the excommunication revoked, he swore to be a layman for the rest of his life and never return to Rome again. This is a matter of debate, obviously, because there are other accounts of the synod where Formosus wasn't even present, and John confirmed the excommunication, so we don't really know what happened. So John VIII died a few years later in 882, and Formosus was then free to be a bishop again, and this eventually led to him being elected pope in 891. So unfortunately, because of his political struggles with John VIII before his death, and the rumor that he swore an oath to be a layman, he would later have some problems. Much later, you know, like after his death, kind of later. Formosus died in 896, as well as Arnulf the Carinthia, who Formosus crowned Holy Roman Emperor in 893. Pope Boniface VI was Formosus's successor and died 2 weeks after he was elected pope. And next up was Stephen VI. So Formosus crowned, you know, there's so many names, so many dates. Formosus crowned Lambert Holy Roman Emperor in 892. And then in the very next year, he gave Arnulf the same title. And so the theory is that Lambert was making a political spectacle to reassert his claim to that crown. However, there is historical evidence that Formosus and Lambert had an amicable relationship as late as 895, which is the year before Formosus' death, so we don't exactly know whether Lambert had a personal and posthumous vendetta against Formosus, but we do know there were enough nasty rumors about him to inspire the bizarre events that transpired next. So in 897, Pope Stephen VI ordered that Formosus' corpse be exhumed and brought to the papal court to stand trial. So they propped the corpse up on a throne and appointed a deacon to speak for him. Now, I know in reality, the deacon just spoke, but I prefer to believe that he hid behind the throne and worked for Moses like a puppet, doing a creepy little voice for him. The accusations against me are false, Your Honor. Regardless of how good a ventriloquist the deacon may have been, for Moses was found guilty of perjury and serving as a bishop, even though he was just a layman. Among other things, I don't understand because I'm not Catholic. Believe it or not, that's not the apical weirdness of this tale. After being found guilty, the corpse of Formosus was stripped of his papal vestments, and Stephen cut off 3 fingers from his right hand that he used to give blessings to people. And this symbolically voided all blessings and ordinations that Formosus gave as Pope, which ironically included Stephen's own ordination to Bishop of Anagni. And he was buried in a cemetery specifically for foreigners, and at some later point, he was dug up, weighted down, and dumped into the Tiber River. So they really had it out for that guy. For little historical evidence of any actual wrongdoing, and even unclear political motives on behalf of the people who carried it out, they went to very great extents to humiliate this man. It's a very strange tale indeed. So that brings us to the end of our creepy tales. I hope you guys enjoyed this one. We might be interpreting scripture, keeping reminders around that death is inevitable and every day counts, having a legacy for the gospel that outlives us, or making right the wrongs of the past, no matter how late in the game that might be. I hope you remember that spooky things can sometimes be the most meaningful. And I'll be back for the regular show on Tuesday and the exclusive show next month. Until we speak again, so long, everybody. Thanks for listening.